Well, let me just chat for a moment. Last night we did Garfield and Gonneau, and my point was that although they never met, if they would have met, that they would have enjoyed each other. I mean, they were on opposite sides politically, opposite sides militarily, but they were both second-generation members of the Restoration Movement. They both had devout parents. They both were baptized into Christ and became great followers of Alexander Campbell, readers of his Millennial Harbinger. Garfield actually ordered all the back issues after he was baptized to catch up. He felt like he was behind. Gonneau was not behind, because when Campbell came to Kentucky, he stayed in his home because his father was the only wealthy preacher in Kentucky and had this marvelous Georgian mansion. And they both loved Christian education. Garfield went to Hiram, but Gonneau went to Bacon College, the very first college in the movement. And then he went to Bethany College to study under Campbell. And even after their college days were over, their love of college education and Christian education especially was so strong that Garfield, as busy as he was, still served on the board of directors or board of trustees for Hiram College in Ohio, and he was on the board at Bethany College, Alexander Campbell's college in Virginia, or West Virginia after the war. And Richard Gonneau, J.W. McGarvey, reached out to him and asked him to serve on the board of the College of the Bible in Lexington, Kentucky. That was a very important school. In fact, he sent his sons to COB, the College of the Bible. The Gonneau boys went home to Kentucky, where the Gonneau family roots were, to study under McGarvey at the College of the Bible. And then when a Christian college was started by the Wilmoth family, called Nazareth University, somewhere down there in southwest Arkansas, they asked Gonneau to be on that board. So the two things that are so, we haven't started yet, we're just reviewing last night. So I won't hand that exam out to Bonnie till a little bit later. The two things that are so interesting about our heritage are the proliferation of periodicals, of journals, of church papers, and the other is the proliferation of colleges. And here are two men that were really involved in both. I didn't have time to say it last night, but Garfield actually is the key player in launching the Christian Standard, which I think may still be coming out. It was down to, has the Christian Standard still come out of Cincinnati? It was getting close to maybe defaulting or being online only. I wrote an article for Christian Standard for the July 4th issue about 3 years ago, so they were still coming out then. I entitled it, A Religious Man for President, which is the quote from Burke Hinsdale, that when Garfield got elected, Hinsdale said, I've been traveling all over the country. People are excited about your election. And what I'm hearing everywhere I go is now we are finally going to have a religious man for president. This, and I chose to use that as the title in the Christian Standard. Garfield was bankrolled by the Phillips brothers out of Newcastle, Pennsylvania, particularly Thomas W. And they put up the money for, this had never happened in a campaign, for the Republican campaign textbook of 1880. And the textbook, which answered every question that could ever come up, anybody who didn't want Garfield to win, every election, all these questions were answered, and the guy who edited it was Burke Hinsdale, the president of Hiram College and Garfield's best friend. And the people who paid for it were the Phillips brothers in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, members of the church. And in at least one state, that made a difference, and that was Indiana, because Otis Burgess, who was president of our school, you know, that came to be called Butler, Northwest Christian University in Indianapolis, he let all those young men out of school, gave them all a copy of the Republican textbook, and sent them all over Indiana. These future preachers in the church went out to defend Garfield, and they had the textbook with them, written by Burke Hinsdale, paid for by the Phillips brothers. I think Garfield wins narrowly in Indiana because of the church connection. I know, since I wrote the book on Oregon, Christians on the Oregon Trail, I know that he he wins Oregon very narrowly because of the church vote. The Restoration Movement was the second largest religious movement in Oregon after the Methodists. I mean, we were number one for a while, and the saying was so popular throughout the region that the Campbellites and the Ferns have taken over the Willamette Valley. And so that, you know, that wasn't said positively. That was said derisively. But on through the 50s, we still maintained a lead for a while. But the circuit riding preachers for the Methodists, that system was so marvelous, their circuit riders, that I think they probably moved ahead about 1855. And at the time of statehood in 59, it would have been Methodist number one and the Christian movement number two, Restoration Movement. And by the time Garfield is up for election, the strength of the Restoration Movement is such that in that narrow election, I think the church vote put him over the top there. I think he thought that. And when you go to First Christian Church in downtown Portland, I've spoken there, they have those eight monuments up in the corners of that massive church building, you know. And you're not surprised that they have the statue, the likeness of the faces of the two Campbells and Barton Stone and Walter Scott. But after you get past those big four, they got four others, and one is Garfield. When you're preaching there, Garfield's up here, you know, look from the left up in the corner looking out at you. So Garfield was a hero figure in Oregon. I'm just buying time here. We haven't started class. Did you stay till the closing prayer? So it's over now. So you think we can start pretty quick here. I'm just summing up last night. All that Garfield and Gonneau had in common. And it's a shame they couldn't have met after the war was over at some gathering of the church where they could just sit down privately and talk about the Alexander Campbell they knew, the church they knew, the periodicals they were impressed with, the Christian schools they had served, and what they had in common. I think they would have had a lot to talk about. Okay, tonight we go in a different direction. The title I submitted, you know, you have to submit these months before, right? Now, let me say, here it is, 10 to 9. I just didn't know they were going to go so late. Anytime you need to get up and leave tonight, you're not offending anybody. Just get up and go. But I'll go ahead and give the regular talk, and you stay for as much of it as you can. When I had to send in a title months ago, I toyed with this idea of doing Carol Kendrick. I've never known anyone to do Kendrick. I mean, I've read our histories. Earl West mentions him a couple of times, not enough for my satisfaction. Most histories don't mention him at all. But when R.L. Roberts and Richard Hughes did that book, The Churches of Christ, 2001, they put in the back R.L. Roberts' biographical sketches, which was over 200 key figures. And R.L. was trying to do some people who hadn't gotten a lot of attention. And there were only five, I think, from the K's, but there's Kendrick right in there between Marshall Keeble and Carl Ketcherside. That's an interesting group of people there. And I think George Klingman was next, you know, who taught at Abilene Christian. So Kendrick came to life a little bit there, but he was never mentioned much in the papers. So I sent this in and decided to give it a try. Dr. Carol Kendrick, born December 29, 1815, died October 2, 1891, about a couple of months before his 76th birthday. So he had a good life. And when R.L. Roberts writes his bio in that book that he and Richard Hughes did, he opens like this: Dr. Carol Kendrick and his brilliant brother, Alan Kendrick. Boy, it doesn't take him long to get off Carol and get on Alan. Alan was. I mean, if we're going to do this right, and I think we will in March at Faulkner University, Wayne Kilpatrick will go ahead of me. He teaches at Florence, Alabama, at Heritage Christian University. He is our best scholar on the Kendrick family. He will do Alan Kendrick and maybe Carol Kendrick in the early years, the Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky years. And then I would do the second class and do Kendrick on his 27 years in Texas and his 14 years in my state of California. And we would put these together. I think we've agreed to do it. Wayne is saying last week, we need to write a book on the Kendricks. I don't know if I want to commit to that. I said I'd write the chapter on Texas and California. But here's R.L. writing, and Dr. Carol Kendrick and his brilliant brother Alan Kendrick were products of the Stone Movement. Well, Alan died in 1859. He was only 48 years old. That's the reason I'm not talking about Alan tonight. I don't doubt that he was brilliant. I don't doubt that he did a lot in a very short life. But Kendrick lives to be 76, and it's Kendrick who comes to my state of California, not Alan. So that's why I'm starting with Carol. So where did I get the title? Missionary Man. Hey, Tom, how you doing? Missionary Man, his travels in Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, Texas, and California. I mean, he preaches in Missouri. He preaches in Illinois and Indiana. When he comes to California, he goes up to Oregon, preaches up there. But I list just these key five states. So why would I call him by the alliterative title M.M., Missionary Man? I couldn't have invented that. I got it from his son, Julian Carroll Kendrick, who wrote a biographical sketch, or it comes out as biographical sketch on Dr. Carroll Kendrick by his son, published in the Octographic Review around 1887. And welcome. Good to have the paperless hymnal with us tonight. If we decide to sing, you could pass out a few copies. He says of his father, and his father is still living, he is practically, when you talk about my dad from a practical point of view, if you're just going to be practical here, he is practically a missionary man and has given nearly 52 years to the work. And he proposes to give all the remainder years, many or few, trusting not in society. He's not a missionary society guy. He's not interested in agencies or societies. Trusting not in societies or the promise of men, but in God's promises alone. And Kendrick sends this off to Daniel Sommer. Benjamin Franklin had started the American Christian Reviews, a significant paper. And following his death, John F. Rowe has it for 10 years or so, 8 or 10 years. And now Sommer takes it over. And Sommer never likes the word American. He's not comfortable with calling a gospel paper by just a nationalistic name. So he comes up with Octographic. That's an awkward one. Octopus, octagon, 8 something. Well, graphic, the 8 writers. It's his way of saying, we are New Testament Christians, and we just follow the 8 writers. Well, he means Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Peter, Paul, James, and Jude. That's fine if one of those 8 happened to write Hebrews. If Priscilla wrote Hebrews, then I don't know what it is for 9. It's non, isn't it? What's 9? If octo is 8, what is 9? 9, non? So then it's the Nonographic Review, and that doesn't sound great. So he goes with the Octographic Review. No one cared for that title, and he eventually changes it to the Apostolic Review, and it stays that way for the rest of the way. But Kendrick sends this article, and that's where I get the idea. The state where Kendrick is born is Nashville. You know where Columbia is here. And it's about 20 miles west of Columbia. But then the family moves, I don't know what this, 75 miles or so, down to this northwest corner of Alabama. What is that, Lauderdale County? Moves down there when he's like 4 or so. Now, his brother's 4 years older. Alan's born in 1811. Carol's born in 1815. But by 1819, they're in Alabama. And what is the event that changes Kendrick forever? And he's going to use that event to change every place he goes. He learns this from the Stone Mulkey movement, more of the Stoneite movement. It's the camp meeting. And I don't know if he went to one before he was 10, but he was at that one Big Cypress Creek. It was either 1826 or 27. Jim Wilburn, when he wrote the biography of Talbert Fanning, said it was 1827. Most people have said it was 1827. But B.F. Hall, in his autobiography, and he's the one preaching, he said it was 1826, and he seems pretty authoritative. We think now it's 1826. So Carol Kendrick's 10 years old, and they have this camp meeting there on Big Cypress Creek up in Lauderdale County. And people are camping out for a long time, weeks. And B.F. Hall is preaching, and he's got a new message, because on his way down, he stayed at the cabin, he says, of the Gist family. But we think now it's the Gist, G-I-S-T, but his spelling is not great. Makes it sound like it's Gist, but I think it's Gist. And they lived on the state line, Line Creek, right there between Kentucky and Tennessee. I think they lived on the Kentucky side. And he shows up on his horse. His horse is worn out. Brother Gist takes his horse over to wash it down, feed it. And the wife is out helping, she said, a sick neighbor. And so he goes into the log cabin to make himself comfortable. And he sits down and he just wants to read some. He's been riding his horse all day long. And he goes over and takes a book and pulls it off the shelf. And, of course, it's the printed copy of the Campbell-McCullough debate of November 1823 in Washington, Kentucky. And this is Campbell's first time. He doesn't do this in the Walker debate in 1820. 3 years later, Campbell, for the first time, argues that baptism is for the forgiveness of sins. And B.F. Hall turns to those pages and reads Campbell's argument. And, you know, you've heard the story that he yells out, you know, in true Archimedes fashion, "Eureka, Eureka, I have found it, I have found it." This great moment where he says, I understood the plan of salvation, I knew the whole arch, but there was a keystone missing in a piece of the arch, and I couldn't figure out what was missing. And when he read Campbell's understanding of baptism in that printed debate at the home of the Gist family, he says, "Eureka, Eureka, I found it." He rides on from there down to Lauderdale County. And in this famous camp meeting, among those who are baptized is Alan Kendrick. And there's Carol. He's 10 years old. He's very impressionable. But his 14-year-old brother is being immersed out there in that big creek at Big Cypress. And the other one that's being baptized in that key meeting is Talbert Fanning. And Fanning, of course, is 6'6". I mean, if you saw him, he was taller than anybody in that area. So when you saw him go under the water, you're going to remember that. And Carol remembered this. He grew up by the Fanning family. And that camp meeting is what stirs Carol. And he's going to, everywhere he goes for the rest of his life, he's going to pull together people in camp meetings. He will do that in Tennessee. He'll do it in Kentucky. He'll especially do it in Texas. And then he comes out to California, and he does it all over California. He is a camp meeting guy, and this is where he learns it. Well, I'll say here, when he starts preaching, he preaches his first sermon in 1835, just for his 20th birthday. But the summer that he's 20, 1836, he preaches all over West Tennessee, and then he moves up and settles in Paris because there's a school. He's interested in education, and he wants to go up and stay in this school, which he does for a year. Then he gets a job teaching. So he comes back to Alabama. This is northern Alabama. And he teaches here in Moulton. And he grew up here in Lauderdale County, about 20 miles west of Florence. But he's teaching here. And now we're up to 1838 or so. And he's preaching all over that area. And when he comes over to Mooresville, he's the one right here by I-65. In Mooresville, he converts J.H. Hunley, H-U-N-D-L-E-Y. And the Hunley family are the ones who build the Mooresville Church. I've only been to Alabama once in my life. I think it was 3 years ago. But I went to Mooresville because I wrote my PhD on Garfield. I mean, at the University of California. That's what I talked about last night. Garfield is fighting in the Civil War, and the leaders of the church in Mooresville send a message to him at the camp. A person rides up and says, "We have a message for Garfield." And they meet with him, and they said, "The Church of Christ here in Mooresville wants to know if you will preach this Lord's Day. We're not a part of this war. We're pacifists. We have nothing to do with this civil strife. But we hear you're a gospel preacher." And Garfield was flattered and preached there at Mooresville. So when I went back and talked to the postmistress of that town, wow, I spent a long time in there. She knew all about Garfield. She was just full of stories. And that's where that begins, with Carol Kendrick baptizing J.H. Hunley. The family that now lives in E.A. Elam's home, because Terry Gardner, last year, took me out there to show me the Elam farm, And the people who live there is Elam's granddaughter, and she married a Hunley. And I said, you know, the Hunleys dominated the church in Mooresville. And he said, I wonder if we're related to them. And they got all excited about they might have a connection with the Hunleys there. Boy, having trouble to go back. Then Kendrick, you know, born in Tennessee, grows up in Alabama, preaching in Tennessee, goes to school in Tennessee, back teaching school in Alabama. Then in 1839, he hears about a camp meeting that's going to take place in Harrodsburg, Kentucky, outside Lexington. And he goes and he describes it. And he says Barton Stone was there and Raccoon John Smith and John T. Johnson and Ailette Raines and John Allen Ganot. And he rattles off these names in 1830. He's a young, impressionable guy, 4 years in the faith. But here are all these greats. And he's not preaching at that. I mean, they're the big names. He's just telling how influential that is for him. In Lexington, Harrodsburg is here. Now, the oldest Christian college is Bacon College, named after Sir Francis Bacon, the philosopher in London, who was famous for the way he rationalized things, the gift of reason. And we were a very rationalistic faith. And so Bacon was a hero. And Campbell was quite disappointed that he didn't start the first college. They felt like they jumped the gun. They didn't have the money. They should have waited. They should have done it like him and start the school on a good financial basis and so on. He doesn't announce Bethany College till 1840, but the first students don't come till the fall of 41. The charter is written in 40, but it's 41 before they start school. But Bacon starts in 1836, but by 3 years, they're out of money. And in 39, they accept the offer to move here to Harrodsburg. There's more money there. If they would bring Bacon College, and so Harrodsburg builds them a nicer building than they had in Georgetown. And so up comes Carroll Kendrick, and he's preaching in this area, and he is persuaded that he ought to go to school at Bacon, and he does in the school year of 1840-41. He starts in September. He goes all the way through June. He studies for 10 months. And they give him a BA degree. I don't think they do that anymore. I think you've got to go a little longer than that. He puts in one solid, I'll admit, solid 10 months school year. He is brilliant. And his professors there give him, they know he's not going to stay any longer. This guy's got, he's preaching. And but he has a BA degree in, you know, in 1841. Now I'll show you the pictures we have. This one I discovered this week, quite by accident, surfing all over the web. A new book has just come out in Texas on the history of the community of Salado. And I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right. S-A-L-A-D-O. Is that right? Salado. And you know that series of little brown books, soft cover, sort of cardboardy cover, that are all over America. Every town has one now, and you can buy them and go into Barnes & Noble, and they'll have 20 towns to pick from in your area. And Salado just came out this year in February or April, just a couple of months ago. And I saw it, and I started going through the book. It was online, and they had this picture of Carroll Kendrick. And look at what it says. Dr. Carroll Kendrick, 1815 to 1891, was a charter member of the Church of Christ. He served on the first board of trustees of Salado College. That was not a church college. That was not a Christian college. That was the community building. But he was so well known as an educator, and he was on the board, and he was a physician, hence Dr. Carroll Kendrick. He went to the same school in Louisville, which is today the med school at the University of Louisville, but it's the same one that Ganot graduated from last night. Richard Ganot went to Louisville Medical School, and Kendrick goes to Louisville Medical School, and both Ganot and Kendrick end up moving to Texas and practice medicine there. He was a physician, educator, writer, and evangelist. That's the photo from just this week. Here's the other one from, I got this from Wayne Kilpatrick. This is in a book, Reverend C. Kendrick, Bryan, Texas. This is after he moves over to Bryan. So this is probably 1872 over by Texas A&M University. And then the one that's in his book, he has the one book that he puts out the year before he dies, and this is a little more full beard. This is Carol Kendrick in 1890. So here are the three. I'm guessing this might be the youngest. His hair is sort of wild, straight back, wild man, missionary man. But even then, high forehead, hair thinning. Now he's combing his hair over. And then here it looks like that he may even be a little older, but I'm guessing there. Those are the three images we have. There's got to be more. So what happened to the Kendrick family? I can only tell you one thing for certain. I'm just getting started on this. But do you remember the announcer in 1952 coming to you from the Highland Church of Christ in Abilene, Texas? And we invite you now to listen again to another Herald of Truth. That was Philip Kendrick. And he was a grandson, I think, a grandson of Carol Kendrick. I need to call the Highland Church. I doubt that Philip is living, but are his children living? And do they know them at the Highland Church? And what happened to the Kendrick? And do they have a trunk that they haven't opened in 30 years that has papers in the trunk and old photographs and maybe a diary? Or, you know, you can dream. So we're in the early stages here. Now, Kendrick loves papers. And early on, he starts writing to papers. And this is the spirit of Kendrick. Listen to this. This is December 8, 1838, from Paris, Tennessee, when he was living up there in Paris. And he's writing to David S. Burnett, the editor of the Christian Preacher. And he says, "I am thankful for the liberty of addressing you these lines. I have been riding in Tennessee and Alabama." He's got that horse, and he is a circuit riding preacher. "I've been riding in Tennessee and Alabama for about 4 months." This is December 8th. So September, October, November. No, August. August, September, October, November. He's been riding through Tennessee mostly. He says Tennessee and Alabama with but little help to preach, but praise be to the King, I have immersed about 100. Whoa! He says that mighty calmly. 4 months he's been on his horse, and he's immersed 100. And this is a fairly young guy in the faith. You know, he's pretty young here in 1838. He's 22, is he? Yeah, he's 22. And he's immersed about 100. "Most of the places where I have labored are much like the wilderness." I don't doubt that. In many respects. But then he writes to the Christian Preacher in the same year. Now we're up to September 23 of... Oh no, that was December 38. This is September 23, 1839. This is 9 months later. And he writes, "Dear Brother Burnett, I have been entirely..." Oh, this is from Tuscumbia, Alabama. That's right below Florence, where Helen Keller was from, right? So in Tuscumbia, he's passing through there. I don't think he ever lived there. He lived, you know, up above there, or he lived down in Moulton. But he's writing from Tuscumbia. And he says, "Brother Burnett, I have been entirely engaged in proclaiming and teaching for the last 7 weeks." That would be 3 in September, 4 in August. Okay, he's been on the road for 7 weeks. "And I have visited Mooresville." That's J.H. Hundley. This will all be on the final a little bit, if you'll keep these straight. "Triana, Moulton, also Morgan County. And part of that time I've been accompanied by a brother, C.H. Gist, G-I-S-T, and some others, and 78 have put on Christ in 7 weeks. 78 have put on Christ, and several others are close." Now, I get old books. People know I want old books, so I get boxes all the time. And this was a woman sent me this from Harriet Hawley. I was a family deep in the church, and I knew her great-grandfather. I mean, I knew, you know, I didn't know him personally. I knew about him. And she sent me some old books, and they're in pretty bad shape, and I'm going through them. Not much in there that I need, but buried down there is Volume 4 of The Christian Preacher. Burnett only put out that paper 5 years, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, or no, 36, 37, 38, 39, and 40. And she had Volume 4, 1839. And these two articles I just read you, I read it because I've got that book. And Now he thinks he's ready now. I mean, after all, he's, what, 23 or 4? He's ready now to talk to Alexander Campbell. So he writes Campbell, and Campbell puts it in the Millennial Harbinger, and here it is. November 11, 1839, now he's in Moulton, Alabama. This is only 2 months later. They had baptized 78. He says, there are several congregations of Christians in this section. We hope to be able to give the statistics next year. I have no help as evangelist in all this quarter, and a great door is open for laboring here. I have, in the last 3 months, I have been riding through northern Alabama, and I have immersed 129. Not 130 and not 128. He's keeping track on that horse. 3 months, he's baptized 128. But he's got no help, he says to Brother Campbell. You know, we need laborers down here. This is amazing to me. So here is Kendrick writing to the... And whose magazine is this? His brother has written at the top, Alan Kendrick, March 24. I got that from Wayne Kilpatrick over in Florence. He's got that actual copy that belonged to Alan. Now, here's the old church building at Mooresville, where he baptizes J.H. Hunley. And then the Hunley family get going. They build this and put a picket fence around it. And then they go out and say to Garfield, would you come next Lord's Day and preach Christ for us? We know you're a little busy here shooting our neighbors. But would you take a Sunday off and come in and preach about the Prince of Peace? Or I'm being a little facetious here. But Garfield is honored and comes and preaches in this church. And, of course, this is a biblical church in the 19th century because there's a door for the men and a door for the women. This is the way they always built those churches. I grew up at the Church of Christ in Biggers, Arkansas, and they still have two doors on the front, and the men and women still sit on opposite sides of the building. That seems hard to believe. But, I mean, we're into the 21st century now. But you would not want to cross over and integrate the other side of the building, you know, with... The genders don't get together at my home church and worship together. They're sitting on different sides of the building. And it goes back to this 19th century pattern. So there's Mooresville. Now he goes to Bacon College in 1840-41, and they give him a B.A. degree. This is the first class that ever got a B.A. degree. They were there for 10 years in that city. 1841 to 90 were the classes, and they gave a total of 27 BA degrees in 10 years. So they're averaging 2 to 3 a year in a graduating class. So how many graduated in 1841, the first time they ever did it? I don't know. I bet Matt could find out for me. If you could look that up next week at Abilene, find out how many BA degrees in that first class of 41, and was there anybody alphabetically ahead of K? I mean, could we make a case that Carol Kendrick is the first college graduate with a BA degree in the Restoration Movement? Well, not quite. I mean, Thomas Campbell went 4 years to the University of Glasgow. Walter Scott, you know, had a degree from Scotland. But, I mean, we're talking America now. And we're talking our own colleges. Who was the first graduate from a Christian college in America? Kendrick was in there in the first group. And if the others were named Williams and Morrison, he was first, you know. I'd like to know, how close was he to being the very first graduate? Only 27 BA degrees in the 10 years, and this is the building. No wonder they moved to Harrodsburg. Now, I don't know when this happened. Some of you help me and do the research and write me in California and put me out of my misery and tell me this. This is the Nashville Airport. Well, before it was the Nashville Airport. Before they built, they laid the runway in the airport out here. This is Talbert Fanning's Franklin College. And Talbert Fanning makes the decision to give Carol Kendrick an honorary MA degree. I'm filled with questions. Did this happen a lot? I don't know. Did Kendrick just pass these master's degrees out when he did gospel meetings? Gave 6 here and 14 over there, and I doubt it. I said to Wayne Kilpatrick, why did Talbert Fanning give Carol Kendrick an honorary master's? He didn't give one to his brother, Alan, I don't think, who R.L. Roberts said was brilliant. He didn't say Carol was brilliant. He said, I'm going to write an article about Carol Kendrick, who had a brilliant brother named Alan. Well, Alan didn't get an honorary M.A. from Talbert Fanning, but Kendrick did. And I asked Wayne, and the best he could come up with was, well, you know, he grew up with Fanning. Well, I doubt if that had anything to do with it. So he's giving honorary masters to people he grew up with in Lauderdale County? I doubt that. But isn't the truth that Kendrick is a brilliant man? And he goes 1 year, and the faculty at Bacon College give him a BA degree, and you say, you go on and preach. We have nothing more. We don't have any more classes to give you. And then Fanning says, I know you're not going to come here and study under me, and I understand you need to go on. You're one of the best evangelists we've got, but I'd like to present you with an honorary MA degree. Was Kendrick honored by it? Oh, my, was he ever. He mentions it for the rest of his life. Any listing of Kendrick is Carol Kendrick, MA. Dr. Carol, I mean, he was an MD, he was a medical doctor, but he was proud that he was an MA graduate, had that MRA honorary degree. But I read Scobie's book on Franklin College again last week. I went page by page in Scobie's book. I couldn't find any reference to anybody getting an honorary MA, let alone Carol Kendrick. It never came up. Mac, do you know any more than I know about that? Honorary MA degree. Well, anyway,
Lipscomb got an MA.
But it was earned.
Well, I'm not sure it was.
Oh, it might have been honorary. Thank you for telling me that. Are you the biographer of David Lipscomb? Now, Kendrick starts editing his own paper when he goes up to preach in Louisville after he gets out of school at Bacon College. And, you know, he goes over to Stanford, and that's where he meets Mary, his wife. And while he's living in Stanford, Kentucky, he debates Nathan Rice, who's already agreed to debate Alexander Campbell the next year, and he wants to practice. And I read one person who was at both debates, the debate between Kendrick and Nathan Rice, the Presbyterian champion, in July of 1842 in Stamford, Kentucky, and then the big debate with Campbell the next year in Lexington. And this particular observer said Campbell did fine. I mean, he upheld himself, and it was a great debate, but he said Kendrick did better. Kendrick won his debate. He was sharp. And Rice just didn't know how members of the Restoration Movement thought, and he was off guard. But he debated him, and then didn't he also debate Talbert Fanning? He debated a couple of guys ahead of time to get ready for Campbell. And I think the other one was Fanning. And I think Fanning regretted debating him. Where am I getting this? That Fanning felt like he was just using me to get ready for Campbell. But Kendrick debated him when he was very early on in his 20s. He takes on Nathan Rice, and he marries this woman in Stanford. Well, he edits the Christian Journal from Louisville about 3 years. And then he becomes the editor of the Ecclesiastic Reformer. That's a pretty significant paper. And the brethren all say to him, we want you to edit this. And he's 32 years old in 1848 when he becomes the editor. 32. And this one is a copy from 1849. This is volume 2, number 7, the Ecclesiastic Reformer. You know the quote on the masthead, not everyone who says unto me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father. You know, that's so that gives you a window into Kendrick. Editing the Ecclesiastical Reformer. Then he edits, when he moves to Texas, he leaves the Reformer back in Kentucky in good hands, and then he edits the Christian Philanthropist for a while. And then that isn't successful, so he becomes, get this, Kendrick is the editor of the Texas Department for the Gospel Advocate and for the American Christian Review. All the way through, starting in 1857, when Fanning has just started the Advocate in 1855, Fanning wants a Texas department, and Kendrick supplies that. The Civil War, of course, interrupts. But then in 66, Kendrick tries to start his own paper again, The Christian Philanthropist. Not enough subscribers. So he edits the Texas Department again through the 60s and 70s for Lipscomb in the Gospel Advocate. But at the same time, he's writing the Texas Department for Benjamin Franklin in the American Christian Review. So that's five gospel papers that he is either editing or writing the Texas Department for. He is really into papers, but he's also got a BA and an MA degree. Really, he's an educator, but he's also a medical man. But he may be the best evangelist going at this time. Well, he's after the Ecclesiastic Reformer, R.L. Roberts and Robert Hughes, Richard Hughes, in their article say this: for roughly a quarter of a century, he was probably the leading evangelist among churches of Christ in Texas, having been responsible for some 10,000 conversions from 1851 to 1877, 26 years in Texas. This is what he writes in the Ecclesiastic Reformer before he goes. 5 years ago, when I was providentially, as I thought, publishing a paper, the Christian Journal, which was doing very well, I was led to consider the wants of Texas. I had long indulged in anxiety to go as a missionary to some distant place where others would not go, and where I might plant the banner of the cross in the name of the Lord. I became satisfied that Texas was the best field of labor open before me. And so he's going to go on to, I wanted to go someplace, he said, where nobody else is really willing to go. And yet, in the time he was there, we had 100 preachers. But R.L. Roberts, who knows Texas, and knows, I mean, he's an encyclopedia, he's dead now, but he's the one that I studied most under when I was at Abilene. Roberts had read all these periodicals. He saturated himself. And when he says, he was probably the most successful evangelist. He either baptized or witnessed 10,000 baptisms. But later, when he says, when later, I'm skipping ahead to when he goes to California, my state, he writes a California letter back to the American Christian Review. This is in 1877, and I think Franklin is still alive. I think he dies the next year. And he says, in 1851, I left Kentucky, and I left the Ecclesiastic Reformer to go out and preach in Texas. And I've been there 26 years. And now, last October, I left Texas to come here to California. And while I was in Texas, I witnessed about 10,000 additions to the cause of Christ, which is about the number I had witnessed before going to Texas. Now, that one I'm not sure about. I don't want to say he's lying. I don't think he is. I think he's trying to honestly remember. But he could be right. I mean, he writes in 1842, that's 9 years before he goes to Texas, that up to that point he's witnessed more than 2,000 baptisms. He's either baptized them or he was there at the meeting. So that means he would have to do 8,000 more in the next 9 years. Well, we know there were several years where he did baptize 1,000 each year. And so it is possible that 10,000 before he goes to Texas and 10,000 in Texas. Now, what I know is that once he comes to California, he's got 14 more years and he baptizes a ton of people. So if he didn't quite have 10,000 before, I'm pretty comfortable in saying that this tradition that has grown up, that Kendrick baptized 20,000 people, or was there when they were baptized, baptized most of them, but was there at the meeting, can probably be established. I didn't think so when I started doing this research. I think now that it can probably be established. And now, how does he do it? Through camp meetings. So R.L. Roberts writes this: Kendrick developed the camp meeting tradition for Churches of Christ in Texas, an evangelistic device patterned after the Stonite revivals in Tennessee and Alabama. Now, I put up the map of Kentucky, but it's. I'll just say that when he first moved out here, he goes to Anderson County. He goes to Palestine, but he helped start that Christian school in Rusk County called Mount Pleasant. And they take out a full-page ad in the Millennial Harbinger in March of 1855. So he's out there trying to get a Christian college going in Texas before the Civil War, and he's living at Palestine in Anderson. Then he moves up here to Bell. He moves to Bell County. That's Salado. And then he moves down here to Bryan County. He lives in, Brazos County. He lives in Bryan. And then he ends up down by Austin in Bastrop County. We know of four different homes he has in Texas, but he's preaching all over the state. And then he comes to my state. So we'll begin to conclude now. Why does he end up coming to California in October 1877? He baptized a man, a German, back in Texas when he first went there, whose name was Charles Vincent, V-I-N-Z-E-N-T, Vincent. And Vincent was even then a successful, wealthy man. And according to the papers I've read, he was the money behind Mount Pleasant School in Rusk County. That was one of our early attempts to get a Christian college going. But then he comes west, and he makes a lot of money in the Comstock Lode in Nevada. I think that's silver, not gold. I think that's a silver mine. And he makes a lot. Then he comes to Oakland. He's a leader of the Church of Christ in Oakland in the Bay Area. And he's the owner of the Golden State Warriors. I just want to see if you're paying attention as I didn't have basketball yet. But he makes a lot of money. He would have bought the Golden State Warriors. But instead, he says to Kendrick, I'll bankroll you. Come help me here, because instrumental music is growing in popularity. The Missionary Society is getting too powerful here, and they're trying to control our churches. Come out here and help me stem the tide. So Kendrick comes out, and he not only wants to evangelize in a new area, but he's also, in his mind, trying to save the church from going down some roads that he thinks will not help the movement. So he comes out in 1877, and he starts preaching all around there. He goes up to Sonoma County. We have a Christian college there with a very creative name. It's called Christian College. And it was started, which is very confusing, but it started by Alexander Johnston from Springfield, Illinois. I'm on the Stone Campbell list, and Jim McMillan and I have been talking about this for the last 2 years on the Stone Campbell list. Alexander Johnston, he moves out, and he's a college man, and he starts Christian College. And when he hears that Kendrick is coming, boy, it doesn't take him long to get a hold of Kendrick and say, come up here and speak at graduation. Give the baccalaureate address. Come up, do a gospel meeting. He does. He baptizes 21 in Santa Rosa. He comes up here to, he comes to Napa County. It's hard to believe that our strongest Church of Christ for a while was in Yountville. You go to Yountville now, that's all wineries. I mean, that's wine country, the Napa Valley. You couldn't afford to live there. That's a wealthy part of our state. And the wine industry eventually drove out the churches. But we had a church that built the first brick church building in Western America, among our people. And it was at the corner of Madison and Washington. I've been there. There's now a Best Western Motel on that corner. But they saved the old bell. It's across the road in that park. And it says, here's the bell that they rang for church at the old Church of Christ here in Yountville, which was, you know, torn down about 1896. But they built that brick building about 1861, 62, right at the beginning of the Civil War. And the preacher was J.P. McCorkle, John Provines McCorkle. And he baptized tons of people. And by the late 60s, early 70s, Yountville was the biggest church in Northern California. But here comes Kendrick out in 1877, and that church is not even meeting. The wine industry has so taken over. And he goes there in 1880, and he starts like May 3 and goes to May 31. And he has 52 editions. And he's preaching with E.B. Ware. Now, I love Ware. He's a historian. He writes The History of the Disciples of Christ in California in 1916. In 2 years, I'm going to bring the book out again, a centennial edition. I don't care if I lose money on it. It's worth being reprinted. And I'm very different from Ware. I mean, he's very comfortable with missionary societies and instrumental music. And he says very unkind things about conservatives in his book. He calls them antis. And he says unkind things, but not about Kendrick. He says Kendrick was a great man. He preaches with Kendrick. And they go up to Yountville and they spend the month. And they get 40 of the old members and say, you need to keep meeting. And they get encouraged. And then there's 52 additions in 1880. And he pulls the church together there. Here's the photograph, well, not a photograph, an etching, of our Christian college in Santa Rosa, which is an hour and a half north of San Francisco, up in Sonoma County. Alexander Johnston, who preached in Indiana and Illinois and Missouri and then comes west, is the president of this school. And on May 5th, 1878, it's in the newspapers, Kendrick is speaking at graduation and he gives the baccalaureate address. And while he's there, he does a gospel meeting and baptizes 21 people or so. Here's what Ware says of him in his book. E.B. Ware, Elias Benton Ware, writes of Kendrick, and he's writing this many years later. Kendrick died in 1891. So, you know, 25 years have gone by. And now Ware is an old man. He's writing the history, and he says of Kendrick, he was a great evangelist of the old gospel type, but he was what we now call an anti. He was opposed to instrumental music in the church and opposed to missionary societies. He was not anti-missionary. That's a good point he made there. If anybody that baptizes 20,000 people, it'd be tough to say, you know, he just didn't have a hunger for souls. That was his problem. He was not anti-missionary, but he believed that the church should manage its own missionary enterprises and not use parachurch organizations or man-made agencies or societies and so on. That's a pretty fair line. But this is a man who preaches with him a lot. Like, for example, this is where... I went with Kendrick down. This is 1878 when Kendrick first got there. I went down to Hollister with Kendrick. Kendrick arrived and continued the meeting. Over the next three Lord's days, there was a good interest all the time. The house was full, and sometimes it was crowded to its utmost capacity, and Brother Kendrick wielded the old Jerusalem blade in an uncompromising manner. I venture the prediction that the seed sown in the hearts of the people will not soon be eradicated. That's where. And... So this is what he writes in his last line about Kendrick, and I love this. He says Kendrick came out here because he was opposed to two things, and he wanted to see if he could eliminate these two things. And so he says of Kendrick, Kendrick made a brave and clean, open fight for what he believed was right, but he failed, at least in Northern California. He failed, and so he went south. He went down to Los Angeles to see if he might be able to stop the church there from going down these roads. Kendrick made a brave and clean, open fight for what he believed was right, but he failed. So he went south, but Kendrick was a great preacher, a true missionary, and a grand man in every way. You would have to know E.B. Ware the way I do to know how stunning that comment is. Because Ware's comments about conservatives in his book are really demeaning and should be beneath him. Despite that, I'm going to reprint his book, and he's on my short list of six graves that I want to raise money and put a marker over their grave. Kendrick lived too long. He lived till 1930. If he had died after he wrote his book, there'd be a marker on his grave. He lived 14 years too long. Nobody cared in 1930. There was a depression on in America. I've been to his grave several times. I asked the woman to come out that runs the cemetery there in Healdsburg. And I said, I want to make sure I'm in the right spot. And she came out with all of her records. And she said, no, you got it right. He's right here. And right. I said, right here where all these weeds are. And she said, yeah, there's a grave marker there next to him. And there's one there next to him. And there's that one. And, oh, yeah, the records are not lying. This is where right here. And I would like to go put up a marker to it. And yet we were different in a lot of ways. But I appreciate his honesty about Kendrick. He was a great man. Almost done. He comes south. And when he came to Los Angeles, he preached in a meeting at Downey, right here, getting close to, you're headed down to Disneyland. You're headed into Orange County, coming out of L.A. And he baptizes 50-some people. This is in 1880. I mean, Garfield is campaigning. Garfield's up for election in the second Tuesday of November, and this is in the early part of the year. And he loves the area so much, he decides, this is where I'll move. I'll make my last fight here. So by the end, by December, he is the regular preacher at Downey. And this is the building. It was the first church building ever built in Southern California by our people. And it was the Downey Church Christ, and then it became the Downey Christian Church. And today there's still a church there. And so I went and got some quotes from Robert French. Now, he's writing in 1969, so he never knew Kendrick. But he's looking at the evidence, and he says, a turning point in the history of the Downey Church was effected when Dr. Carol Kendrick was called to the Downey pulpit early in 1881. It's actually December of 1880. He brought with him nearly a half century of valuable experience as a medical doctor, a preacher, editor of religious journals, and a church organizer. And this line, for the next 10 years, from December 80 until he died in October of 91, for the next 10, actually 11 years, Dr. Kendrick would lead the Downey Church to an unrivaled position of influence and evangelistic activity. The church at Downey soon became known as the Jerusalem of the South due to the evangelistic activity of Dr. Kendrick. That's the way they talked in the 19th century. What was the Jerusalem of the North? It was the church at Woodland in Yolo County, northwest of Sacramento. Everybody referred to it as that way. It was that way because of the two great leaders, Pendergast and Lawson, Joshua Lawson and J.M. Pendergast. And they weren't Campbellites or Stoneites. They were from the Mulkey movement. I mean, they were from the Mulkey Stone movement, but they were right in there by the Mulkey Meeting House and those counties right around Mulkey Meeting House and just below into Tennessee. But they built the strongest Church of Christ. And when you get out the history of Yolo County, and the person writing the article there is not a member of the Church of Christ, but the historian who wrote that said, from this one church, the Church of Christ in Woodland, from this one church, the culture of Yolo County was shaped and formed. Now, I've looked at those histories in Houston, Texas, where we have a million churches, and I've looked at the histories of Davidson County, where we have 128 churches. I have never seen a county history that said of one of our congregation that it shaped the culture of that county, but I want you to know it happened in Northern California. It happened in Yolo County, it happened at Woodland, and it happened because of Mulkey's people. I got criticized for including Mulkey in the Big Five instead of the Big Four. I included Mulkey, and Leroy Garrett never forgave me, still hasn't forgiven me. Kept saying, Jerry, it won't do, it won't do, it just won't. But who influenced me? R.L. Roberts. He was convinced that Mulkey should be in the Five and that his image should be here in front of the Disciples of Christ Historical Society, not just the other four, that Mulkey was that significant and powerful. But we don't even have a photo, an image of Mulkey. It's his son. You know, when I in my Christians on the Oregon Trail, I had a round oval and it was empty. I didn't have a photo. And Leroy didn't like that. I mean, he reviewed my book wonderfully, but oh, that really drove him crazy that I had the two Campbell, Stone, Scott, and an empty portrait. And under it said John Mulkey. And then there were all the people that wrote me from all over the country sending me pictures of his son saying, what do you mean there's no picture? Look at this. Here's John. That's John Newton Mulkey. I haven't found it. R.L. couldn't find an image. But he took me to John Mulkey's grave, and I looked at that hill and those, you know, weeds up to here. And he said, let's go. And I said, R.L., it looks like a lot of snakes in that grass to me. And he said, oh, he didn't deny it. He said, come on, they won't bother us. I would have felt better if he said, no, there's no snakes in this part of Kentucky. He said, they won't bother us. And off he went. I thought, I'll never be here again. So I guess I can die on this hill right here. I followed R.L. up that hill. I thought they'll bite him first. We got up there, and we pulled weeds, and there was Mulkey's grave in the middle of nowhere. But R.L. knew where it was. I should have run a picture of his grave, I guess. I didn't have a picture of him. But anyway, they called that church at Woodland, you know, the Jerusalem of the North, meaning this is our most influential church. And so Downey became the Jerusalem of the South. And then French writes, with Kendrick's death, a great moving force and influence passed from the church scene. Although stubbornly narrow, meaning he's not going to give us instrumental music, and he's not going to give us missionary size. So this is written by a disciple of Christ. Although stubbornly narrow in some regards, he was thoroughly Christian and a kindly gentleman. So, Kendrick says, when in Texas, I witnessed about 10,000, and that's about the number that I... and he says, which is about the number I witnessed before. And in all this labor, I have measurably sustained myself, not by tent making, as Paul did, but by medicine. He was a doctor. And he wrote the book right at the end of his life, 1890, Live Religious Issues. Oh, it's a big, thick book. And who did he talk into publishing it? David Lipscomb at the Gospel Advocate in Nashville, Tennessee in 1890. And he thought this would help, but the book is difficult to read. Kendrick was something to behold and to hear preach, but the book is dry as toast in parts, and it never became a bestseller. So I end with how I began, with his son saying, how to sum up my dad, he was a missionary man. He was a missionary man. That's what he was. And when one brother, Hodgson, wrote in a paper, he talks about how great Kendrick was as a preacher, and he says, before closing, I just want to say that Brother Kendrick is one of the ablest men in the Scriptures I've ever heard, and he works with a will and a great zeal, and any church would do well to secure him, if you can, for a gospel meeting. And then when his obituary was published in... this is the Gospel Advocate. I don't know who wrote this. Maybe Lipscomb. But he says, we learn that Kendrick has died and that he said at the end, I prefer to go to the grave in a plain spring wagon. And I would like some brother to read 1 Corinthians 15 concerning the resurrection and eternal life. And I would have them sing some glad and happy songs. I trust unwavering in the mercy and promises of my Savior. I do not regret any labor, suffering, or expense for Christ's sake. I wish I had done and sacrificed and suffered more for Jesus. So Lipscomb or somebody writes, he was a grand and good man, as all will testify who associated with him. He was kind. He was gentle. Yet he was firm. And he was true in his convictions of what was right. I close with this. One of his elders was Tobias Grider, and it broke Carol Kendrick's heart when he died. He had to preach Grider's funeral. And he sent this in to the American Christian Review that Tobias Grider, in his 76th year, has died. His large family of children, grandchildren, so on, everybody's grieving here. A great crowd accompanied the remains to the grave where the Bible was read and prayers were offered and one song was belted out, you know. And then this is what Kendrick says. It has been almost 50 years since I first met Brother Grider in West Tennessee. He was a Christian then, and I believe he honored that name, and he was an honor to the church to the close of his life. There was not a spot upon his blood-washed robe. This is how Kendrick wrote. There was, you know, the robe is the robe of character. You've been washed in the blood of the Lamb. Washed your robes and made them clean. He says, there was not a spot in his blood-washed robe, and the church, I think, never suffered on his account. He was one of our bishops here at Downey, and he will be greatly missed. None can miss him, however, as does his aged companion. The separation was truly pathetic. Though it is to be so brief, she'll be with him again. I believe all of his children are children of God. May they before long be a whole family in the house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. I broke the loaf with him on his last Lord's Day. He took the bread in his trembling fingers. And he held it for a little while, and he said, thank you, Lord. Amen. And then as he put it into his mouth, he added to me, I reckon it will be the last time. So it was, but we shall commune anew with him in our Father's kingdom. That's the best I can do with Carol Kendrick right now, but there's a lot more there. Kendrick is worth remembering. And I hope to pick this up at Faulkner University if I can get Wayne Kilpatrick to do Allen. I think that's next March at the Bible lectures. We are way late. I apologize. We were supposed to be done at 9:30, but we got started really late, and it's 9:45. And I don't teach tomorrow night, so I'm done for this week. Tomorrow night we have fireworks and celebrate July 4th and so on. Thank you for coming. I enjoy every visit here to Lipscomb. Enjoyed teaching here now for 9 years, and we've gone through a variety of classes here in 9 years, but it's been fun. And we have one full day to go tomorrow. I fly back home on Wednesday. We're dismissed. Have a good night. See you tomorrow around campus.